So, you're back with us. How is it going? Do you have any questions? Anything you'd like to talk about?
Hi. I know that it's normal for the first few days of a retreat for meditation to be pretty scattered.
Yes.
But I'm experiencing meditation that's like worse than the practice at home. Is that what you would call normal? Or?
Yeah, that is pretty normal. That, it's amazingly consistent. Every now and then somebody will start off their retreat right the way their practice is at home and just start getting better right away. But most of the time, the first couple of days of retreat are a combination of being more scattered than usual and very often more dull than usual. Partly because of all the things that you did to get ready to take the time off, the travel, and everything else. And then the other thing is it's a big change. Your routine is your daily practice. You're in a routine. Your mind sets aside its other concerns for that short period of time. But here, your mind's not quite so willing to set aside all of these other concerns. And so a lot of the things that might not come up, say you're sitting twice a day, might not come up in those two times during the day because there's lots of time in the rest of the day for it. Here, by the time you get into your second and third sittings, that just is wanting to be taken care of. The other thing, too, in addition to it being a change of environment and a change of routine, is that there are much fewer demands, and that's usually why the Dhamma comes in. But it really is. It's quite normal. It's quite normal. There's nothing wrong.
I've been noticing when I practice that sometimes there's this desire to be on autopilot. It's like there's a part of me that just wants to be on automatic pilot and not wake up. It really enjoys being asleep. I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. Well, maybe you've got a good autopilot. I don't really know what to say about that. I think maybe, do you mean by that? There's a comfort zone, and if you're going to wake up, it means you've got to take yourself out of the comfort zone and do a kind of work that you don't usually do. Is that what you mean?
I guess it's sort of an enjoyment of just letting the mind wander and you think about this and you think about that and these different things come and go and just kind of like an enjoyment of that or something, I guess.
I suppose so. I find the behavior of the mind when you just let it go to be really rather disappointing. Kind of rehashes all the same stuff. Comes in pointless circles. I'd be happy to say more. I don't know quite what you'd like to hear.
It's the same as her question. Is that normal?
What's that?
I guess just that it's okay,
Well,
if that happens, it's not.
No. It is okay. Yeah. it is okay. I mean, after all, there's a whole world of billions of people who let their mind just go wherever it does. And so that is the very definition of normal. And for those of us who would like our minds to behave differently, that's not normal.
Well, I don't know if this is what Terry was trying to ask or not, but this is what came up for me when I heard Terry's question is, why is there the enjoyment or attachment to suffering mental states that makes it actually hard to want to move towards independence, since yesterday was 4th of July, because there's this actual, like, no, but I enjoy suffering. Why is there that enjoyment of suffering?
Well, that's actually a good thing to think about and talk about. Is why are people the way they are? Why do we? Why are so few people motivated to try to make their lives better? That's kind of what I hear in the question. Now, I don't know that anybody really enjoys their suffering, but we tolerate it. And also, I find that to a certain degree, well, maybe it is a kind of enjoying your suffering. A lot of us base some of our identity on our suffering. A very popular thing for to talk about, you know, exchange woe is me stories, these are my problems, and everything like that. And certainly it becomes part of our identity, and so maybe it is an enjoyment in the sense of being the way that we cling to our selfness. But you know, the bigger question that I find really interesting is why is it that so many people seem to accept things the way they are, even when they're pretty bad, even when their situations are pretty terrible. Why are they less motivated to do things? You know, and you brought up an interesting thing. Yeah, yesterday was the 4th of Independence Day. And if you look socially, what is it that brings a society to the point where it's willing to make changes, start a revolution, throw the bums out, bring new bums in?
Yeah.
I mean, not that violent revolution always works particularly well. As a matter of fact, it seems like, on the whole, it doesn't. Nevertheless, things in the world keep do improving because people do reach a certain point where there's something or other where they don't tolerate it anymore. And then change happens. You know, a very formative thing that happened in my life was living in the South, growing up in the South, and then having a civil rights movement arise, and then having massive social changes associated with that. And And the two questions that there's always been for me is, one is, how on earth did this happen? Because, you know, at the time I was growing up, it seemed like it was absolutely impossible, but that kind of changed. If it did happen, it just seemed like it was unreachably far away, and so very, very difficult. So on one hand, it's how it's happened. On the other hand, you look at it and say, why didn't it happen so much sooner? Why was it tolerated for so long? I think it's the same thing is operating on an individual level. People adapt. It's important to be able to adapt. So we adapt to our circumstances. And we get used to the way things are, and we don't have a lot of motivation to change. Of course, the other thing is, the more difficult your situation is, often means that you have very little time and energy to change your situation. Some of it is maybe not even knowing that change is possible. Most people would agree with the it's a rather inadequate formulation of the first noble truth, that life is suffering. And most people would agree with that. And most people, they come from a place of life is suffering, but there are some good things, and so if I try hard enough, I'll have enough good things to compensate for the bad things, and maybe I can work everything so that the balance of good things is greater than the balance of bad things. You know, I'm reminded of the way that amphibians, you put a frog in a pot of cold water and put it on a fire, and it warms up slowly, and it never occurs to the frog to jump out until it's cooked. It's become a dinner frog later. On the other hand, you put a frog even in warm water and it immediately jumps out. We get used to our circumstances. There's resistance to change. There's a lot of utility in being used to our circumstances. Then there's not knowing how to make things different. And then there's been too busy fighting off the alligators to realize, remember that the solution would be to drain the swamp. And I wonder how we can change that. Because it seems to me, and it probably does to most of you as well, that the problems of the world and individually the situations of individuals in this world are just going to get worse. Unless, of course, we do something about it. So we're all in the same situation. Individually, if we're realistic, we might be lucky, but what we're looking at forward to is a lot of pain and suffering, a lot of struggle, a lot of disappointment. And you do lose everything eventually. You lose your health. You lose your ability, your physical ability, your mental abilities. the things you enjoy and the people you love. One way or another, you lose them. And as the world becomes more overcrowded and depleted and inequitable, all the things happening to it, in the way it affects all of us, it just makes me wonder, it's like the situation with racism in the South when I grew up. On the one hand, I look at it and say, how come nobody seems to be motivated to change all of that? Why is this a little willingness to make change? And of course there are individuals who are totally dedicated to that. Probably some of them are in this room. You probably know those, but why are they so few? Because it takes enough. There has to be enough voices, enough movement, enough action to make any difference. And why is that not happening? And then on the other hand, you look at the nature of life, and you look at the way things are going in the world, and that's the other question. Well, you know, even if we all woke up today and went to work on making things better, is it possible? How do we do it? Well, I know, and you know, that on an individual basis, it is possible. And we know the means to do that. Interestingly enough, I think that the very same answer provides the resolution to the bigger problem. If enough people woke up individually, well, first of all, if enough people took responsibility for their own happiness and well-being and started to do something about it, then then we'd also have the solution at hand to a bigger problem. The solutions to both are the same. That the suffering that we experience as individuals is due to ignorance and craving. And because of ignorance and craving, we experience suffering that we otherwise wouldn't have to, and we inflict suffering on others that we wouldn't otherwise do. And it's because of the same ignorance and craving that we're collectively destroying the ecosphere that we depend upon to live. And the nature of the ignorance is the same, and the craving is the same. If enough people woke up, then you make a difference to the whole world. So the question, back to your question, I would say, why do people enjoy their suffering, but why are they so complacent, and why are they so unwilling to do anything about it? Then you're all doing something about it.
So are a lot of other people.
And so are a lot of other people. So. But, you know, I think maybe where Jesse's coming from is we all have the same problem. It's on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, you know, we know the things that that we should do, and sometimes we find it very hard to do those things, right? What are our thought processes? Well, things aren't so bad. It is kind of nice to just let my mind wander rather than try to train it this way. Sure, they create all kinds of problems for me the rest of the time. Right now, it doesn't seem so bad. So. All I've got to say is I'm glad that you're motivated to be here. And as far as knowing how to make change, I certainly want to help you with that. But ultimately, you've got to want to change. If you think about it in terms of the five hindrances, is everyone familiar with the five hindrances? Anybody's not? You're not?
I think I
would
be able to list them all.
You wouldn't be able to list them all? Okay. Well, I'll list them for you. But two of them, I think, are relevant to... Many, they're all relevant. Two of them are worth talking about right now. Okay, so the first is worldly desire. And the second one is the will and aversion. The third one, this is one of the ones that I was thinking of talking about now, is laziness and lethargy, or as you sometimes call it, find it, you know, the sloth and torpor. So when you Europeans translated these things into language that they could understand. They translated the hindrances of laziness and lethargy into the sins of sloth and torpor. Laziness and lethargy is the third. Then there's agitation of the mind, specifically due to worry and remorse. There are a lot of other sources of agitation, but agitation due to worry and remorse is the main category of hindrance. It's something that's built into us. And then the final one is doubt, and that's the other one that I thought was worth looking at this afternoon. So all of these hindrances exist because they are valuable. They don't exist as hindrances, they exist as built-in mechanisms that help us to survive and cope in the world. And probably easy enough to figure out how we need to have a tendency for desire for certain sorts of things and aversion to certain other sorts of things in order to survive. Laziness and lethargy, you might not realize the degree to which that's actually a beneficial adaptation. Laziness is a tendency that keeps you from expending your time and energy on things that are unproductive or useful. useless, or that you could do more in some other way. I mean, all the wonderful labor-saving inventions that we enjoy the benefits of, we owe them all to the laziness, right? People didn't say, you know, I don't want to do this, there's got to be a better way. And laziness is always pushing us to do a kind of cost-benefit analysis. Is this really worth? Is this really worth the trouble it's taking? And that happens with spiritual practice as well. It requires effort. It requires that we do something that's not as much fun as something else that we think of doing. And it requires us to make effort that we can easily see ourselves not making. So to overcome the hindrance of laziness, you need to keep your level of motivation and inspiration high, so that you've always got easy access to the answer to the question when it comes up in your mind, is this really worth it? Lethargy, you know, this is a built-in conservation mechanism. When you don't have to be doing something, or when you can avoid doing something successfully, then rest. Conserve your energy. You might need it later. Go to sleep. Have a nap. Laziness and lethargy kind of work together, because what they both have in common is creating a resistance to doing things, which can lead to procrastination, or anyway, leads to resistance to doing things. So it's a serious hindrance. But it's a hindrance that you need to deal with. You need to make sure that you have enough rest, and that you have enough motivation and enough inspiration to do the things that you need to do. And just as it's easy for you to slack off and not be diligent in your practice, it's easy for a whole lot of people out there never to even begin practice. It's easy for most people out there to not even confront the question of whether or not they should really consider doing something to improve the quality of their life. The other hindrance is doubt. And it's really closely related to these. When we get an idea when we plan to do something, we immediately picture how well it's going to turn out, right? All the wonderful benefits that we'll have. How great it will be once this is done. And then we start to work on it. And of course, it usually turns out to take more effort than we had envisioned in the first place. Even more than that, if you're doing something really worthwhile, it probably doesn't go really easy to begin with. If it's something really worthwhile, something new and different, there's probably going to be some periods there where you're not successful. How many times how many different light bulbs did Edison make before he got one that would actually stay lit for him every time? Anybody familiar with that? I don't know the number, but it's some astounding number. You picture, how could this guy go to all this trouble, of making a filament out of all these different things, cotton, wood, different kinds of wires, everything else, sealing it in an evacuated glass bulb and then passing electricity through it just to see it go.
Yep.
But he kept doing it. So one way or another, he was able to overcome doubt. But doubt's a good thing. I think when the going gets rough, doubt makes us question, you know, is this really a good idea? Is this really worth pursuing? Should we continue on with this? So we've got to look at the good side of doubt. Doubt produces an emotional reaction. And the emotional reaction is, hold it, let's have a look at this. That's the emotional reaction. And the thought that accompanies it, of course, is maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe this is a waste of time. Maybe this is not a good idea. So it's an emotion, and it's a particular kind of thought. But the thought really is a question. Maybe, maybe not. Where doubt becomes a problem is where you respond to the emotion of doubt, and you don't answer the question. So yeah, this is where on the one hand, doubt's a good thing because it makes us question. On the other hand, doubt's a bad thing if we just throw our hands up instead of answering the question. And the most powerful way of overcoming doubt is through success. And every kind of success, any kind of success, this is going to answer the question. So, in terms of your practice, you'll experience the hindrance of doubt. Can I really do this? You know, sitting there, you peek out, oh, like everybody else looks. Maybe I'm different. They all got something I don't. You doubt yourself. Or you doubt the method. You know? Maybe this is the wrong way. Maybe this is the wrong way for me. You know? Maybe I should try something different. But you could try a lot of different things and get to just about the same place. But the doubt comes in. So, oh, well, no. Maybe I should try the next one. There's enough things to keep you busy switching your along. Maybe you doubt the goal at all. And, you know, does this really produce the kind of results that I'm hoping for? Maybe this isn't really what was promised. Maybe where I think I'm heading, maybe that's not really where it goes. Or maybe they were just lying to me. The doubt can take all these different forms. Doubt will come up over and over again. Of the hindrances, that's one that will keep coming back. All the way in new forms, more sophisticated forms, and then you know, it's really interesting. The argument that comes in your mind. Okay. Here I am, three quarters up my way to the top of the mountain. But maybe it's not worth going the rest of the way up the mountain. Or maybe when I get there, I'll find nothing. It would be no different than where I am right now.
Find a bigger mountain.
Yeah, you know, maybe I'll get there and find out, oh, what I thought was the top of the mountain isn't. It's just a ledge. The real top is up further. Now it can take a lot of forms. When laziness and lethargy and doubt kick in, if your suffering is not too bad, you probably look at the two and say, well, maybe I'll just take the suffering. At least for today.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll feel different about it tomorrow. First tomorrow, what might happen is that suffering is so bad that you're not in any condition to do anything about it, or the opportunity is gone. The only opportunity you really ever have is the present. That's what comes to mind. What else should we talk about? Yes, Deb.
If the only opportunity we ever have is the present, how do we avoid burnout?
How do we avoid
burnout? Because burnout? The present is always the present, and it's always the right time to.
No.
That's right.
Well. Yeah. The present is always the present, and that's all we got. But the future is going to be the new present, and what we do in the present is going to determine the nature of the present that we live in. So we've got to do something about it. The trick of being in the present is to totally accept the past. Because that won't change. You have to totally accept the way things are right now. You know, the best way to do that is if you can convince yourself provisionally that this, everything is perfect right now. So I'm not going to worry about the way things are. But the present is an opportunity. So how could things be better? What can we do? Then your problem is to figure out better according to what standard? What is better? Then it gives you something to do in the present. What you can learn from the past is that if you don't do anything in the present, things are just going to get worse. And if you overdo in the present, or if you spend your time worrying about how things are going to get worse, you do either one of those things, then you've lost the present. So it's all a question of finding just the right attitude to accept the way things are and to find meaning and purpose and what you can do. You know, we're interesting beings. We really, you think about everything you do. Why do you do anything you do? It's because we're always looking ahead to the future, and we're geared to be able to. I mean, the difference between you and a rock is the rock doesn't have any ability to predict what's going to happen in the future. But you do. Of course, a rock's not in a position to do too much about it. But you not only predict the future, you have the opportunity to do do something about it. So that's what purpose is, right? That's what ultimate cause is, right? According to Aristotle. We call it ultimate cause, we call it final cause. I can't remember. But anyway, you know, what's the reason why you do something? I think it's the result.
Final cause.
The final cause, yeah. It's the final cause. You know, we live teleologically. You know, teleology, why is this way? The teleological answer is, it is this way so that that will be that way in the future. This wheel turns so that it will cause that wheel to turn, which will cause the vehicle to move, which will carry the stuff from A to B. So that's the place that we exist. We exist in the present, and we're doing things for the sake of the future, because we have this unique ability to be able to somewhat predict the future. So, now your question, the being that we are the way we are, how do we keep from burning out in the present? Okay. Well, one thing we do is we save ourselves all of the trouble of worrying about the past and regretting the past, feeling bad about what we did do that we could have, or we did do that we might better not have, or that somebody else did that we wish they hadn't, or so on and so forth. So keep from burning out in the present. We just drop all of that, because it doesn't make a bit of difference at all. Get rid of that. Then, we're in the present, and some things in the present are good, and it might be that they're good because we did something in the past that helped make them good. Okay. So, but there's other things that we thought things were going to turn out a particular way, instead they didn't. I thought I was going to have this juicy fruit, except that the cage door closed behind me as I grabbed it. Well, the other thing, this goes along with the first thing, not worrying about the past, is that learning not to be attached to the outcomes of our current effort. Because a lot of the burnout in the present comes from looking at the things that you tried to do that didn't work out. Okay. So let go of all of that. Just enjoy the things that are good about the present moment. And then, here you are in the present, and you want to do something. You have this mind that lets you forecast the future to a certain degree. So you can choose to act. I mean, of course, you can choose to not act, too. And that can be fun for a little while. The best way to not burn out is to have some kind of really clear standard, some guidelines for how you can choose what to do at the present. Your purpose, your intention. Now that's really important. You have a clear intention, and that intention is based on something that you can trust. A lot of your burnout is going to come from the feeling that, oh man, I totally wasted my time, my effort, my money, my everything. That was the wrong thing to be doing all of that. What was I thinking? How deluded was I? I I was sure that if I, you know, when I took my inheritance to Las Vegas, I'd leave with enough money to live on the rest of the time. What a hate. No, you have to have some really good, reliable standard. You're always living in the purpose, so one way to put that is you're always living in the present, sorry. Always living in the present. So one of the things that you want to do is live a life in the present that's a life of meaning and purpose. So that's where you have to have some guidelines. So when you have those guidelines, then you can live in the present. You can live a meaningful life, a purposeful life, and not be attached to the outcomes. Instead, when the future becomes the present, you just learn from your mistakes. And you continue leading a life of meaning and purpose. So, if you ever find yourself starting to feel burnout in the present, then that's the time to learn a lesson from the past. And maybe you need to adjust a little bit the standards by which you're basing the meaning and purpose of your life. Or perhaps you need to work on loosening up the sense of attachment that you develop around the goals that give your life meaning. So those are the things that you need to do. So that standard, that becomes really important. You know, if you follow me in this kind of dissection of it, it does come down to the values that you hold. And here's where we kind of strip bare the problem. Most people are operating from a set of values which doesn't work very well for them. And so they experience a lot of suffering, they create a lot of suffering, and experience a lot of burnout and disappointment as a result. So you need a set of values. That's what the Dharma offers. That's what the Dharma offers to me, that's what the Dharma offers to you. You can understand the set of values and principles and apply them, then you have a kind of guidelines to live your life in the present, live a life of minimal suffering, very strong sense of meaning and purpose, strong sense of satisfaction. Does that answer the question? In general, it does. In principle, it does.
The particular problem that I was, it does answer the question, but the particular problem that I was speaking to is the one where I tend to try to do stuff to the point where I get too tired to do anything, and I keep doing stuff because I feel like I should keep doing stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then at some point I reach a breaking point, and at that point I just go into full lazy mode and don't really do anything for a while, and then after a while, I start to get that sense of dissatisfaction with how things are going, and then I go back and start making efforts again, and you know, the cycle repeats itself. And how do I get to the point where I'm kind of doing the right amount of effort and not too much and not too little?
Yeah, I can relate to that totally. I relate to that totally. I do the same thing. I can't do nearly as much before I reach that point now because I used to, and so it takes a whole lot of mindfulness. It takes a whole lot of mindfulness to see what you're doing and understand what you're doing. You know, you're absolutely right. You do the same thing over and over again. You push yourself too hard, and I know that I relate totally to what you say. It happens to me all the time. You get tired to a certain point, you can't even think clearly enough to know where it's time to quit. Right? That happens to me, so I relate to it. The only thing is, when you get to the point that you realize that that's what you've done, you have to think about what you should have done. No, and it's not, I don't find that it's enough to say, well, I'm not going to make that mistake. you actually have to kind of relive it and figure out where you should have quit and what, had you been wiser, what you could have used to tell you when it was time to quit. And I'm finding that that helps. But it takes a lot of mindfulness. It takes a lot of the kind of mindfulness that's defined as knowing what you're doing, knowing why you're doing it, knowing whether or not it's really what you want and should be doing. And knowing that continuously. Because you start in on a project, and yeah, I know what I'm doing, and I know why I'm doing it, and yeah, that's what I want to be doing. But there comes a point where you start to lose that mindfulness. And so you don't know that it's no longer what you should be doing. You may reach a point where you no longer even know why you're doing it. You're just doing it. And of course, along with that, you find yourself not even really knowing what you're doing. Which tomorrow, when you feel better about it, you'll look and say, wow. I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah, and so I relate to that totally. And that is a problem. But all of the things they do apply to that. But, you know, mindfulness, that is the answer. And it takes mindfulness to know when you're losing mindfulness. And that's the tricky part. You've got to have enough mindfulness to know you're losing mindfulness before you've lost too much.
I was thinking that, like adding some kindness to your mindfulness. My teacher in Busan is always talking about adding a little kindness to your mindfulness. And that makes it seems like that's sort of one antidote to burnout, because you're doing it in a way that's less likely to be driving yourself. You're kind of doing it with this attitude of like taking care of yourself while you're doing it.
I agree with that, you know, kindness, but I think it comes down to the other thing is that you have to have values and you have to apply those values to yourself. And it's very easy to value a goal or a project or someone else. You know, you could be doing something for somebody else. You could be doing something out of love. And you allow yourself to slip into a non-equanimous situation where you're valuing yourself and your own well-being less than the project, and that's a mistake. That's having it out of mind. That would be a case of not being kind to yourself. So, yeah, if you can remember to be kind to yourself, that's really important. So my answer is, how do you keep from burning out? Well, you have to train yourself to be mindful. And it's the only answer I know. I don't think there is any other answer.
So, in the way that the 10 stages are laid out, and the way that what you've written in the book, and it's very linear. I mean, in the sense that it's this and then this, and it, and my experience has been different than that. I mean, there have been periods of time where it felt like that linear thing, and then I felt, oh, and then it made, like, I was, like, trying to get attached to that continuing and that trajectory without, you know, going this way. And so, as a matter of fact, I've had a lot of back and forth, and as you know. But I'm wondering if you could speak to that, and as I think that maybe other people experience similar experiences. It's not just about having like a bad day, it's more about having like periods of time where things shift gears or change direction.
Well, see, it's really true that it is. You know, in order to lay it out and describe it, we have to look at the complicated, swirling motion of reality and pick out, well, you know, it's like a scatter graph of points, and picking the best line through it. More like what I did. In order to communicate it. But it's not like that. It's more, you know, it's more like a spiral than it is a straight line. It's like you go ahead and then you go back, and then you go ahead and go back. And the net effect over time of this cycling back and forth is that you do follow, that there is a line through all of these points that you're at, you know. But if you put all the points on a graph day by day, hour by hour, week by week, whatever, you know, they're all over the place. But that pattern does within it. There is a linear trajectory. And the challenge is how do you describe the trajectory in such a way that people really understand that there's going to be all this back and forth. Because otherwise, it's you know, talk about gallop. Oh, I finished my last retreat, stage 5, now I'm to stage 3. And then there's another thing that's operating too, is that there's a lot of refinement that takes place in these skills. You can become pretty skilled at not being captured by distractions when your overall mind state in a period of time is such and such, and your environment is so and so, and there's not any huge traumatic things trying to grab your attention. But everything's always changing. So one of the things that happens when you cover the same ground multiple times is if you covered this ground, but it was easy ground. The next time you're covering it, the reason you had to go back and cover it again is because now you're covering a different, tougher version of the same terrain. But by the time you get back to where you were before, you're a whole lot better at dealing with those kinds of problems than you were the first time around. And so is that kind of refinement. And in terms of a multi-part process like this training of the mind, there's certain aspects of your mind that, you know, they don't all get equally well trained at the same rate. So sometimes you have to go back and do a better job of some things that you didn't do quite as good a job of the first time. So it isn't linear. And, you know, another thing that plays into it is you're not the same person every time you sit down. You're a different person. There is some causal continuity between the person that you were last time and the person you were last week. but you're always a different person. You have changed. You're living in a different world. And you're different. The world's different. Everything's different. So you're plotting a course through all of these different things. So, yeah, how to convey that in such a way that people don't develop unrealistic expectations and get disappointed? And that's the challenge. You know, the place of illustrations in the book. In the very first illustration in the book, figure one, it's two panels and it says, your progress through these stages will vary from one set to the next, and even within the same set. The first panel shows a meditative area. It's got different calendar pages over his head with a ten stages scale. You know, and see that it's at this stage here, and then it's at this stage here, and then it's way down at this stage here. And the second panel is the same thing. The one that says more during the same set. Only now it's a clock, right? So I don't know, you know, people are still down to want their progress to be linear, but I think at least having the very first figure in the book be one that tells them it's not going to be that way. Hopefully it'll help.
That spiral was good.
The spiral would be a good thing, too. You see, I have this problem that even the thing that I described to you, until somebody else who's better at visualizing things than I am, you know, actually put something on paper, it's like, yeah, that's what I got. And so I don't know what this spiral thing would look like. But probably be a good one.
Time's about up, but I was just going to put one little bit onto that. I've noticed that if I can, particularly if I'm like, if I'm talking to you or having a meeting, for example, or if I'm for some reason reviewing a long period of time, then I see that the progress in a different way. But like to get myself to stand back that far almost and like just be like the observer of that is pretty I don't know why I don't think of doing it on my own. But that doesn't happen really often. Can you give any tips about or like ways that might trigger you to want to just do that on your own and be your own? When I was in retreat, I would write things and look back, and then I could be kind of, I was like, I knew I was my own cheerleader, but now it's like getting that kind of perspective seems more challenging.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any tips.
You know, the biggest step is to recognize that this is how your mind works. And you know, this I've noticed about myself in so many different ways, so many different dimensions, is that it's very hard for us to remember how we used to be. You know, however we are, it's we kind of know we were different, but not really, not enough to make that difference. So that's why, you know, keeping some kind of notebook or some kind of record that is very, very helpful. But it's just, it's a tendency that we have. And I found it's not just me, everybody does this. And that gets coupled with another thing that's good to keep in mind, just to know that your mind does this so you don't get tricked by it, is your mind is naturally designed to look for problems, and so it will look at anything that's going on and want to see if this is a problem. Is this something I should worry about? Is this something I need to do something about? And the effect that has is that you're inevitably focusing on the negative because of that latter trait. Your mind tends to be, you know, filled up with the clutter of is there something wrong with this? Is this a problem? This could certainly be better. And the other thing, put that together with the other thing of not remembering who you used to be, how things used to be, how your meditations used to be, and you have this feeling like, well, it's always been more or less like this. So here you are, cluttering your mind up with all of these those things of all the negative, potentially worrisome things, and then blinding yourself to seeing how much progress and improvement there really is. Just remember that your mind does that. And whenever you find yourself experiencing doubt or laziness or resistance or disappointment or impatience or restlessness or any of those things, if you could just somehow cue yourself to say, okay, I know the way I'm seeing this isn't an accurate reflection of reality. And then deliberately do the other. So instead of trying to figure out what might be wrong, spend a little time thinking about what's right, what's good. And then if you've kept any kind of a journal to help jog your memory, or anything else that you can do, just to help remind yourself that you really are doing well. Everything really is okay. You know, and you can do this for somebody else. Like, you can go to somebody else, and it's very easy for you to do it for somebody else. It's very easy for you to come to me and talk about your meditation. I can help you see that. It is harder to do it for yourself, but you should give it a try. Figure out some easy way to, some little mnemonic that you can use to remind yourself. Kind of string around your wrist or rubber band around your finger. When I start feeling discouraged, disappointed, impatient, whatever, let me try to get a more accurate perspective on things before I go too far down the road. Best I can think of. You know, I scheduled the talks for this time of day because it's not a very good, it's kind of a low energy time of day for everybody, right? Anybody feel low energy right now? So it's not the best time to meditate, because you have to deal with a lot of drowsiness. But the other thing that I realized very clear today is it's also not the best time to have a really enlivening discussion. I don't know, we can try to turn that around. I'll try. You try. I do rely a lot on inspiration from you. I noticed that the chime on my clock that it's
intense, but not very loud.
Yeah, upstairs, do something. Hopefully that's loud. Has it been reasonably loud for you? should behave. Okay, well, thank you, and I'll try to be more energetic tomorrow, and you know, if you ask me questions about things that you really care about, you really want to know about, you'll get the best I have to offer.